You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network.
I'm doing a little experiment here, so hold on. Hold on. Bear with me.
For over 70 years, one image has stood above all others as a symbol of patriotism, valor, and service. A World War II icon that represents the values of the U.S. Marine Corps.
As a Marine, that image captures the fighting spirit and the willingness to overcome all obstacles in order to win.
It has inspired books and movies. The flag raising is immortalized in one of our most revered war memorials. But now a new investigation suggests that the official record is wrong, and the picture conceals an extraordinary case of mistaken identity.
How can this be that history could be wrong and there could be a mystery flag raiser somewhere?
It's taken a number of remarkable people from many different backgrounds to unravel this 70-year-old mistake. Prove that one brave man has been completely ignored by history. An unsung hero whose place in this most celebrated image can now be revealed.
We have an amazing, uniquely American mystery.
Joining me is the man who produced that, Matt Morgan, Lieutenant Colonel, United States Marine Corps retired. So, Matt, first of all, thanks for coming on this morning. Appreciate it. And how are you?
Thanks. Great, Mac. Doing well. I just got to spend the day at the museum yesterday in Quantico and had a great opportunity to discuss the process and the identification process from the Marine Corps' perspective, and it was a great day.
Talk to me about, Matt, let's just do a little quick reintroduction of you. Matt, born and raised where?
I was born and raised in East Central Illinois, a little farm town out there, and went to the University of Illinois on an ROTC scholarship, got commissioned in 93.
It's commissioned as an infantry officer, yes?
Yeah, well, coming out of basic school, right? I was an infantry officer, so by the skin of my teeth, managed to get infantry during the days when we actually had to hang a physical tag on a pegboard in order to get our MOS. I'm sure they do it by computer now, but so yeah, I was able to get infantry, and from there I went to first LAR. Deployed the 15th MUSOC, came back, and through a series of unfortunate events, found myself becoming a public affairs officer.
So you become a public affairs officer, and then you wind up in working in the Los Angeles office of Marine Corps Public Affairs, yes?
Yeah, that's right. My first assignment as a PAO was at Marine Corps Air Station El Toro. So I went from being infantryman in the 1st Marine Division to being a PAO and at the Marine Corps Air Station, so it was quite a culture shock. It's probably as radical as a culture shift as you can get within the Marine Corps, right?
So a little bit.
And then a couple years later, they had a hot fill they had to push up in L.A., so they swept me up there and ended up working there for almost 4 years. About halfway through, they had to move the director out of there, and so they leaded me up to that job and got the opportunity to run that office independently as a captain, which is a pretty exceptional opportunity.
Wow.
To be almost 3,000 miles away from your reporting senior running an independent office in the biggest city in the country.
Well, and arguably one of the most influential public affairs jobs in the Marine Corps. Let's talk about your introduction to the entertainment industry. Let's just complete it. So, and then you get out of the Marine Corps when?
Oh, 2013.
2013. Right.
You know, I was in Los Angeles on 9/11, and so I kind of recommitted myself to, you know, it's my time in the Marine Corps, and you know, before you know it, you're a major, you're over 10 years, and you're a company man.
Right.
So, but the Marine Corps kept offering me new opportunities, great opportunities, and there were a few jobs in the Marine Corps I would say I did enjoy thoroughly.
All right. And so, so talk to us about, while on active duty, you're introduced to the entertainment industry. Tell me about that experience. What was that like as you begin to, as an active duty Marine, you begin to look at the entertainment business? What was that like? It's certainly a different world.
Yeah, the shift was almost surreal. I mean, one of the first things I got assigned was just the Marine Corps project officer on the JAG television series. So I learned a lot. It was actually a very friendly production company to work for. The production relied very heavily on Marine Corps assistance to provide them what the business calls production value. That is the opportunity to film on bases and installations and have, you know, that millions of dollars worth of equipment as a backdrop for production. You know, it's stuff that they effectively are not paying for. And honestly, the only time we charge them for anything is if we're flying an aircraft directly in support of the production, and then we backbill them based on these charts that the Department of the Navy gives us. You know, so, like, I don't remember what it was exactly, but I remember it was like $1,800 per flying hour for a CH-53, you know, and that's an all-in cost. So we would bill them back and for that type of stuff. But for the most part, they got a great deal of production value, quality assistance, and technical consulting for free.
So, and obviously you're the guy who's coordinating that kind of support.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the thing that what they would do is send us scripts for each episode regularly as they were working toward a production schedule, and we would make comments on it. If there was something we concerned about, we would work closely with the showrunners, you know, the lead writers on the show, to try to work through whatever it was. You know, the challenge, of course, there with JAG was that it seemed like at times it was every other week it was a Marine getting in trouble. You know, so you had to balance that out. Showing, you know, due process and the positive side of military justice and the fact that for everyone out there who's being, you know, a dunderhead, you've got thousands and thousands of Marines who are excelling at their jobs every day. So that was a bit of a challenge in some respects, but and then so if they were requesting some sort of cooperation in exchange, then we would arrange that, whether it was shooting at Miramar or El Toro or some local installation. I mean, we even brought LAVs up to the Veterans Park up in LA at one point, I remember, for an episode, or 46s up to Van Nuys where they were shooting. So that type of thing, you know, and the Marines and the crew and everybody else gets the opportunity to perform their duties on camera as part of that production. And by and large, Marines generally enjoyed the experience.
So did it affect you in terms of watching this whole process of how entertainment is created in terms of maybe possibly becoming part of that? When does it occur to you that that might be something that you would enjoy doing?
I think the first opportunity we were working on a film production of the name of the movie just went out of my head, Samuel L. Jackson and Tommy Lee Jones in the film, and it was actually written by Jim Webb originally, the script was, and it was a story about two Naval Academy graduates who had come into the Marine Corps as officers and started their careers in Vietnam and now were colonels and had their relationship challenged. And, you know, that was actually ostensibly based on or inspired by Jim Webb's relationship with Oliver North. But the studio had issues with the script, and after Webb was unable to fix it to their satisfaction, they hired this 24-year-old kid to rewrite it. And the kid was actually a pretty decent writer, but there was a lot of stuff that he couldn't quite get right. He didn't understand or didn't appreciate military culture, certainly not Marine Corps culture, the idiosyncrasies of the relationships between Marines. And so I had the opportunity to collaborate with him on that script at length. And that was a point. And a couple years later, or not even a year later, that writer named Steve Gagan won an Oscar for a Best Adapted Screenplay for the movie Traffic. And I looked at it and I said, well, listen, if I can work this closely and do this well with a guy who can win an Oscar, I think that I can probably contribute in a more meaningful way, long term.
All right. So now you get out and, walk me through, was, The Unknown Flag Raiser, Was that the first thing that you produced when you?
Yeah, it's the first full producer credit that I've had. You know, when I was in Los Angeles, I met a recently retired Marine Sergeant Major named James Deaver, Sergeant Major Deaver. He and I had known each other briefly on active duty because he was at First Force. He's Sergeant Major at First Force when I was there at Las Flores at First LAR. And so he came up to my office shortly after he retired, and he was getting his feet wet in starting to work as a full-time technical consultant in the industry. So Deaver and I worked closely together on two feature films, and then I had given some thought to working with him. We actually started a company together with the thought that I was going to be getting out of the Marine Corps. That was in the months in the summer leading up to 9/11.
Okay.
So yeah, when 9/11 happened, then I called Deaver and said, "Hey, I'm gonna take a rain check on this." And so that we stayed in touch through the years, and he over the years grew and expanded his reputation. Went back to working for Clint Eastwood on two films, Flags of Our Fathers and Sands of Iwo Jima. And then
wait.
Some years
Sands of Iwo Jima.
I'm sorry, Flags of Our Fathers and Letters
from Iwo Jima. Just so, I thought you did that to see if I was paying attention.
No, but I'm glad I'm paying such close attention. So we were just talking about Sands of Iwo Jima yesterday, as in the flag raising in popular culture.
You're to be forgiven then. All right, so you work on those.
He was working on those, and I was still on active duty.
Okay.
And he worked on a number of films. If you look up his filmography, he's worked on more than 47 feature films in his career since about 1998, 1999. And a lot of them very, very high level visible, feature films, and as well as a few television series. And, so in 2000 and early 2013, before I retired, he gave me a call and said that he was having some difficulties in meeting all of the demand for his requirements, that he was going to be consulting on this remake of the 2014 remake of Godzilla, and asked if I'd be willing to work with him on that. And so after that, we started working together, and we've worked together on several films since then. But it was actually his work on the 2005 production of Flags of Our Fathers that started our interest in the flag raising mystery, so to speak. And it took us about almost 10 years to kind of come up with some kind of solution where we felt like we had enough that we could actually put a documentary project together.
So the seed germinates. Talk to me about, and then you get off active duty. A lot of people aspire to become producers, whatever. You obviously had more connections than most, but it certainly is a leap into the abyss. How does one go about? You have an idea in your head. Is the first step to sell the idea, is to get the money to produce? How does one do this?
Now, so if you're talking nonfiction, if you're going to look at producing something like we did with the Unknown Flag Raiser, what we did was we put together a proposal, and we partnered with the production with a known producer who was excited about the idea.
Okay.
And then with that, we managed to get a relatively well-established production company in New York interested in the concept. Just so happened that one of the principal partners there at that production company was a producer named Kim Woodard, and Kim's dad was a Marine, her brother's a Marine, she's got a strong connection to the Corps, and he was also a former executive at National Geographic, so she saw the potential in the story. And so that was the first step, but it still took us well over a year after that to get a network interested. For us, the big challenge was just kind of a chicken and egg situation, where the networks were adamant that the Marine Corps would be involved in the process. The Marine Corps was adamant that we have an established relationship with the network before they would move forward. And so we had to kind of balance that out. And we finally managed to get an agreement in place after the Marine Corps had fully examined our evidence and arrived at a conclusion. So at that point, we were really behind the eight ball in throwing this project together quickly to get it ready for air because we didn't have a lot of time. You know, usually the issue for a documentary series or a long-form documentary project is you've got two ways to do it. You could either go out and seek the funding yourself, produce the documentary, and then try to sell it, or you could put together pitch material and present it to a production company or partner with a production company and present it to a network and get either development funding or full production funding from the network.
So it's
a relatively involved series.
Kind of like building spec houses. You can assume the risk and build the house and hope somebody buys it, or you can you know, go partners with somebody, hoping that they'll see merit in the idea, yada, 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 in terms
right.
of...
It's very much like that, except for the fact that the market, it's imagine as if your architectural and market trends were changing from quarter to quarter. You know, ranch houses are selling like hotcakes
right.
today, but if you build a block of spec houses, ranch spec houses, you may find that, two-story duplexes are the big thing next quarter. And that's the big struggle with networks, is that the market changes so rapidly, and production timelines are very difficult to fit in within the changes in the market timeline. So you really want to be in a position where you are presenting a network with the next best thing. And that's the biggest challenge.
The next best thing. My guest today is retired Marine Lieutenant Colonel Matt Morgan, and he is the worst half of Angie Morgan's life, and she's appeared on here, a former Marine officer, and been helping us out with Marines on management. And Matt produced. So Matt, what would your appropriate title be, because you just talked about you worked with a producer out of New York. So if he's the producer, what are you?
I'm the producer, and when you get into how you produce various formats, depending on the format, the credits can vary. In the documentary format, we had executive producers, and those executive producers were the partners in the production company, and then there was an executive producer from the network.
Okay.
The produced by credit is usually reserved for those individuals who are directly involved with the day-to-day production, that is the process of shooting, writing the script, editing, and delivering the final product to the network. So I have a produced by credit on this film. So, you know, and that's notably for our perspective, that's the produced by credit is probably, I mean, I would think it's the more respected credit in terms of the industry, because if you were to, say, win an Emmy or an Oscar, it's the guys who do the produced by credits that are guys that are walking up the stage to get a trophy.
All right. So. All right. A couple other questions. You mentioned there's a difference between fiction and nonfiction relative to what you present and how the entertainment business looks at those two genres. What's the difference?
Well, I mean, primarily, if you're looking at documentaries, a documentary series, the only way that you can, really the only way to be, make it a career, so to speak, is to work in television. Certainly there are long-form documentaries that are theatrical releases, but the market for, I mean, when is the last time you went to a movie theater to see a documentary? It's a very small market, tends to be only in major metropolitan areas, right? You know, New York, Los Angeles, some Chicago, maybe Austin, Texas, or places where you might be able to screen a long-form documentary in a theater. So most of the market there is in television. There's also long-form scripted television as well, which you've seen networks like History and Smithsonian and Discovery get into more recently. You know, History has produced the Series 6, which is ostensibly inspired by SEAL Team 6. That is a scripted series that was produced by History. So you can work in that environment as well. Then there's more traditional long-form scripted television, and that would involve taking a series concept to a network, selling it to the network, and then having the network order either a pilot or a limited run on that series to get started. And then, of course, the other side of that is the long-form feature film environment, which is extremely challenging to break into.
Okay. All right. So you go down this road, and you, particular in terms of bringing this to market, how do you get plugged into the Smithsonian Channel? Because they have it's their brand, very high quality, right? Very well researched. I mean, the Smithsonian, obviously, the connotation is the Smithsonian Institute. So talk to me about how you find your way to them.
When we initially began talking to the Marine Corps about the project, we told them up front that whatever we did, we wanted to have a high journalistic standard. We weren't interested in doing anything sensational. We knew that, based on the information that we had, that if there had been a mistake, it was not a conspiracy at any point. It was just an honest mistake. And what we thought was more interesting in the reveal was having an opportunity to revisit and present the Battle of Iwo Jima to an audience that was unfamiliar with it, and then to highlight the individual sacrifices of the Marines and sailors and soldiers who fought there. But for the Marine Corps, from their perspective, it was essential that the partner that we brought in be a network. And so we really narrowed it down to National Geographic and Smithsonian. So we were talking to both. And right as we were getting ready to execute with Smithsonian, they were purchased. The National Geographic was, I'm sorry, right as we were getting ready to work with National Geographic, they were purchased by News Corp.
Okay.
And which is the parent company of the Fox News Network and the Wall Street Journal. And, right. And so when that happened, every single executive that we had been working with went away. So we saw an opportunity then to go approach Smithsonian. And they were immediately interested, and thankfully they were willing to sit down with us and the Marine Corps and pull the trigger. So I think that we would have liked to have more time to tell the story, more than the 44 minutes we got. But then at the same time, I think that it forced us to be disciplined in the way that we told the story.
How much, if you would have been given your druthers, how much time would you have could you have used? I know you could have probably done it for days, but what would you have said would have been the optimum time in terms of storytelling?
We could have easily cut it into a feature documentary format, so ranging between 90 and 120 minutes. You watch the documentary, and there's a relatively minimal amount of time spent with Colonel Severance, for example, the Easy Company commander on Iwo.
Right, right.
We have just straight up 90 minutes of conversation with Colonel Severance. The time we spent with Ralph Griffith, who was PFC there on Iwo and was standing next to Sergeant Mike Schrank when he was killed. I have extensive interview materials with him. The opportunity to talk more about the story of Iwo and get into things like the fog of war, and then the opportunity to talk about when the guys came back, how they were brought back for the 7th War Bond Tour, why they were brought back. And you think about from a Marine's perspective, just think about the logistical challenges involved in identifying Marines in a newspaper photo 30 days after the photo had been taken, after these guys have been in nearly 36 days of sustained combat. Identify them positively, bringing them back to the United States and sending them out on this war bond tour. I mean, it was a substantial logistical undertaking, and it's frankly surprising more mistakes weren't made in the process.
My guest today, Matt Morgan, United States Marine Corps Lieutenant Colonel, retired, and documentary filmmaker. What title do you hang on yourself now relative to what you do, Matt?
Writer and producer.
Writer and producer.
So, and consultant kind of gets thrown in there as well. I mean, well, we worked on. One of the first projects I did after leaving the Marine Corps was American Sniper, most recently, I think the most recent released film I've worked on was Arrival. So, and in those environments, we're just paid consultants, and in many respects, we're paid just as much for them to ignore us as they are to listen to us. It doesn't really matter. at the end of the week, invoice them the same dollar amount whether they listen to us or not.
All right, Matt, we got to take a break, and when we come back, I want to talk to you a little bit more about the entertainment business and things that you've learned and maybe advice that you would give, and I've got a few emails for you, so you don't mind hanging with us, do you?
Nope, not at all.
Okay. Matt Morgan, our guest. And then we got to talk about the little project that you and I are working on that's going to make its debut on Monday. So we'll tease that a little bit as well. So Matt Morgan, here, graciously joining us on a, Friday edition of All Marine Radio right here on the All Warrior Radio Network. This hour of All Marine Radio brought to you by our friends at Battle Mug. The Battle Mug starts out as a 10.5 pound block of T6 billet aluminum, milled, machined, and anodized. And it's a truly unique product. Each mug is serialized and built with operators in mind, with Picatinny rails on it, right? Those are the rails on your M16, M4. So because of that, scopes, lasers, cameras, lights, all of that, anything you can put on a rail, you can put on your mug. So designed with the operator in mind, just as easily converts into an office accoutrement with unit emblems, with flags and whatnot. So it's a great gift. You can check their entire line of products out at battlemug.com. Enter the promo code Marine for 15% off. Battle Mug is a veteran owned and operated company, Marine originated, made entirely in the United States. So check it out. More of All Marine Radio coming up next. We'll continue our discussion with Matt Morgan on what it is to be a documentary maker and his observations on the entertainment industry next right here on the All Warrior Radio Network.
All I can say about MilitaryByOwner.com is, wow, I listed my house on your website for only 2 weeks in a tough rental market, and now my house is about to get rented. I will definitely recommend you guys to everyone in the military. Thank you.
Are you located near a military base? Advertise with Military by Owner for optimum exposure to the military community. Military by Owner has experience helping military families find, sell, or rent their home near a military base for the past 15 years. MilitaryByOwner.com, proven and dependable.
My name is Juan Perez Jr. I joined the military in 98. I commissioned as an officer. But I always had in mind the idea that I would go into the special operations community, particularly the special forces. I was accepted to go into selection, and I attended on September 8th of 2001. As I was making my departure out of the military, there was that uncertainty. What do I do next? How do I repurpose my skills in a way that's not only meaningful to me, but also that provides for my family and provides an increase in our a way of living, a quality of life. The Global South Foundation has resources when it comes to anything from building resumes to how to relate to a CEO in conversation, how to basically, again, repurpose that which I had learned in a career in special operations, dealing at the strategic and operational level. How do I take that and then turn it towards entrepreneurial spirit into business development? And how do I translate that so somebody can see that value? And in doing so, I landed a magnificent and very rewarding career. I'm the VP of operations for an IT company called BuildSourced. What I say to veterans getting out, be bold when you go to network. Go out to the Global South website, look at what events they have lined up, attend those events, you know, and participate. A lot of the events they hold, they're of key importance in this network. Go out there and engage, just like you would engage in a combat zone, you know, when you're networking there. With folks that don't share necessarily your language, your culture, or your background, and yet we still make it happen. How can we not make it happen here?
The Global Soft Foundation is a great partner of All Marine Radio. Find out more about them at globalsoftfoundation.org/Marines.
A message from DAV to all returning veterans. Thank you. Thank you for doing your duty. Thank you for doing our bidding. Thank you for laying it all on the line. Thank you for stepping up and not backing down. Thank you for putting your future on hold to put our enemies on notice. Thank you for putting your buddies' lives ahead of your own. Thank you for putting yourself in harm's way. Thank you for defending our freedom, for displaying your honor, for being a hero, even though you don't want to be called one. For all this and more, DAV thanks you, and we're here to help you. Expert DAV advisors will make sure you get the health, disability, and financial benefits you were promised and earned. If you're a veteran, visit DAV.org for free help. And again, thank you.
General Sergeant Arlie Ermey here with important information for veterans.
at 2,600 American job centers nationwide. Veteran and transitioning military personnel can find help with career counseling, resumes, and job placement. You want more information, don't you? The Department of Labor offers a variety of programs to help our military heroes find good jobs or continue their education. What are you waiting for?
We all have the ability to touch the lives of those around us. Moms, dads, neighbors, teachers, friends. These are the people who are always there to listen when we need to talk. Though their actions may not always be monumental, they are always felt. To someone going through a difficult time, a text, a call, or a visit can mean so much. Reach out to the veterans in your life today. Let them know they're not alone. One simple act can make all the difference. That's the power of one. If you're a veteran in crisis or know one who is, visit VeteransCrisisLine.net for free 24/7 confidential support. Or call 1-800-273-8255 and press 1.
You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network. On a Friday morning. Mike McNamara with you for a Friday edition of All Marine Radio right here on the All Warrior Radio Network. Hope you're having a great day. Thanks for spending us spending some of it with us. And I'm joined by Matt Morgan and graciously holding with us through the break. And Matt, I've got a couple emails for you. So let me get to the first one. Hey, Mac. Enjoy hearing Matt as always. I've got an Iwo Jima question for him, as well as a entertainment industry question, so please bear with me. First question, what does he find, relative to the research that he's done, the most intriguing part about the entire Iwo Jima battle? It may or may not have to do with his documentary, but is there something that he found or discovered during his research that absolutely intrigues him? So, Matt, is there another documentary in your research? What intrigues you about it?
Well, you know, without getting into there's the battle itself has been studied to death. I think what was most intriguing to me was the contrast between the modern Marines experience and the World War II Marines experience, and it has nothing to do with the technology or the weapons. It is that in 1943, December of 1943, Harold Schultz enlisted in the United States Marine Corps, and he went to boot camp, and he joined 5th Marine Division in the spring of 44, and he trained with them, and in late 44, he went to Hawaii, and he trained some more. And then in February of 45, he lands on Iwo Jima, spends about 15 days there before he gets wounded. He's evacuated from the island. And by the fall of that 1945, with less than 2 years in service, he's been discharged. So I think that we should be very proud of the fact that today we have the opportunity for units to train together, to deploy together, to decompress together, and to have the kind of training pipeline that we have, the fact that when I put that all together, that Schultz was not even a year out of boot camp when he landed on Iwo, it was pretty stunning.
You know, and it's also sober when you think of replacements who weren't part of those companies that you landed. I mean, how did a replacement get trained, Matt? I mean, so our company's going to go out. Where these replacement guys, what do they do when our company goes out?
And right. Those replacement companies were trained on Tarawa with the Camp Tarawa. On the Big Island, you know, with the rest of them. But, you know, then those guys get, you know, thrown up on the beach and attached to another unit. And you've got to, you know, in many cases, you'd have a PFC who is now the squad leader, and the sum total of his combat experience is the number of days he's been on that island. I mean, the fact was the Easy Company, really only about a quarter of them had any combat experience. Their NCOs and most of their officers, several of their officers had combat experience, but not all of them. You know, because the 5th Marine Division was put together, their leaders came from the Raider Battalions and the Parachute Battalions. And then the rest of those guys, you know, composited in straight out of boot camp.
Okay. It is easy. It is interesting, the training of the 5th Marine Division in particular. I just, I ran an interview that I did, and I know you've heard it yesterday, but with a PFC at the time on Iwo Jima, Cal Humphrey. And I ran that interview yesterday where he just talks about their training, about meeting Manila John Bazalone at the slop shoot at Camp Tarawa, because, you know, they could go down there and drink beer for 15 cents. He said John was a great guy, and he talked about him. And so it's really interesting and, I think, riveting stuff from when you hear it first person, but, you know, he talked about the replacements and trying to make them smart when they came up. And, hey, you need to walk there, and don't be afraid to shoot your weapon at anything, and shoot it a lot, and don't stand up, for God's sakes, and all the little things that those guys learned. But that was Humphrey's only battle. As you said, if they were new, let's just say on day 14, I mean, he had 14 days of combat experience more than they did. And so
that's
you're
right.
interesting stuff. Next part of it, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, that's why, you know, I talked to the Marines who served in 2nd Platoon Easy Company, in Mike Strank's squad. Mike Strank, one of the flag raisers, of course, who was killed there on Iwo just days later, and Mike was 24 when he died. But every single one of those guys who's still living, chokes up when they talk about him. They loved him. They looked at him as a god. And many of those that survived felt like they made it off the island because of the training that Mike Strank had given them.
Yeah, that is, you know, even after all these years, the reverence that guy, that name, is spoken with is still, you know, pretty powerful stuff when you hear it. Very moving to hear it. The next part of the email talks about this. You see so much produced these days about the combat experiences in Iraq and Afghanistan. And I think all of us wonder about stories we have in our head. Would somebody ever be interested in this? So, Matt, what makes a story interesting? What makes a story sellable? And at some point, do you have to let go of it if you have an idea so that they can take it and blow it up to make it entertainment and it simply isn't a recounting of the actual factual events? Could you talk about that? So, and a lot of guys must have ideas, man. I'm sure you get it a lot.
Right.
What makes an idea, worth somebody investing in?
Well, let me take a step back with the big picture, and that is to understand that the motion picture production process is a collaborative process. And there's almost no way any human being is going to take a fully formed idea and just put it on the screen and have it exist unadulterated. It's just the nature of the film business. And I would even say that there used to be maybe a dozen filmmakers in Hollywood that could get that done. And that number has been reduced even further. Today it seems like Clint Eastwood's about the only guy who could just take a project and do it the way he wants to do it, not have the studio mess with it at all. And I would point in the individual toward the story. I worked on a film in late 2015 that's currently titled Megan Levy, and it's about the experiences of a Marine Corporal MP dog handler in Iraq in 2005-2006. And I will tell you that it was probably one of the most frustrating motion picture production experiences I've ever had, because watching the director, you know, so you got a writer that's talked to Megan, who's a, you know, former Marine Corporal, medically discharged due to, you know, injuries she suffered in an IED blast. And then the way her story gets filtered through a writer, and then we put the script and we read in things and we're like, this doesn't make sense. And the writer says, well, this is how it's told to me, because we see things very differently and hear things very differently because of our experiences. And then there was a first-time director who was assigned the project who had absolutely no understanding of the context that she was given. And so that was very frustrating. And I think that I would tell you, Mike, when the movie gets ready to come out in December, or I'm sorry, in June it's coming out, I'd encourage you to get Megan on the phone and talk to her about her perspective on that subject alone. Because getting your story up on the screen in a completely unadulterated fashion is a very long shot. That said, I think that the best course for any individual who has a desire to tell a story and to see that story up on screen is to go to the very best film school you can get into. And that is probably the best and most reliable, not a guarantee, but becoming a filmmaker is probably the best way to do it. I tell you, having worked as a technical consultant and, you know, good relationships with producers in the industry, I can sit in the office and talk them through something I think is a great story, and I will get, yeah, but. You know, like we were talking through a story about 3rd Battalion, 5th Marines set in the Upper Sangin Valley in 2010, in 2011. And it was, the producers said, yeah, but the enemy, it's not really clear who the enemy is. And I'm like, that's the fucking point. You have a very clear view from a strategic perspective of what you should be doing. But from the grunt's perspective, in Sangin Valley, it is, you know, your job is to stay alive and kill bad guys in that order, no questions. I don't give a shit about this drinking tea. I give a shit about this clear hold and build. We're just going to go out. We're going to patrol. We're going to kill Big T Taliban, and we're going to stay alive. That's it. And hopefully you'll get out of here with both your legs. And they just, it's very hard to tell those kinds of stories, especially when you don't have people with proper context in Hollywood. That's why I encourage veterans to go to film school and get involved in it, because you look at the best World War II movies that came out in the late 40s, early 1950s, it's because they were written, filmed, and directed by veterans. That's why those experiences, and that's why those war movies can speak so effectively to the veteran experience.
Matt Morgan, my guest, another email. Matt, let me just ask you, film school, explain what that is. Being able to use your GI Bill, go to a university that has a film program, yes? Or are you talking about a specific trade school? Talk to me about films, go to film school.
Four-year university, schools like Columbia, NYU, USC is a very highly regarded film school, UCLA. You know, there's a lot of film schools out there, and like I said, it's kind of like the same advice about college, which is go to the best college you can get into, go to the best school you can get into, and worry about your degree program later. If you're going to look at film school, and like, go to the best film school you can get into, look at the top film schools in the country, because those are going to give you the opportunity to learn the trade, and then you're going to leave film school, for example, from USC. If you leave there, you have an opportunity to get into the Directors Guild of America program. And it means you're going to enter in. You're going into a new business. It's just like entering the Marine Corps. You're going to come in as a PFC. You're going to do the scut work. You're going to stay up late and do schedules and fax crap and get people coffee. But that's really probably the best way into the industry, because in the end, it's the labor unions really manage the way that the industry is structured. And to me, that is probably the most reliable way. Now, if you're the best writer we've seen since Aaron Sorkin and you can just blow them away with the scripts, do that. But, you know, learning to write screenplays in itself is a trade and craft.
Matt Morgan, my guest here on a Friday edition of All Marine Radio. Another email. Hey, Mac, good to hear Matt again. And I'm curious about the conference that he attended in Quantico, if that's where it was, or D.C. Was there any new ground broken relative to events in and around the correction of flag raisers on Iwo Jima, or was it simply an affirmation of what we've already known? So Matt, anything new come out of the conference that you attended?
No, nothing really new. I mean, we had the opportunity when we approached the Marine Corps, when the production company approached the Marine Corps, we provided them the history division with all the information we'd collected and the case that we had made for the identification of Harold Schultz. And the director of the history division, Charlie Niemeyer, he felt that it was compelling enough that he took that to General Neller, and General Neller felt that it was compelling enough that they needed to convene board to examine the evidence itself and look at everything available that the history division could bring to bear on it. He asked retired Lieutenant General Jan Hewley to convene a board to do just that. And so General Hewley spoke briefly about the direction the Commandant had given him. Mary Reinwald, Colonel retired, who is now the editor-in-chief of Leatherneck Magazine, was part of that board, and she provided basically a rundown of what the board looked at, how they approached it, and what their conclusions were. In fact, describing the process that they had gone through to arrive at the same conclusions that we had, and finally make recommendations to the Commandant. I didn't get to hear exactly how they had approached that. There was an interesting presentation from the National Archives and Records Administration. Interestingly, when we undertook the effort to identify the Marines, one of the things we wanted to get at was the original stock, film stock, that Bill Janoust had shot of the flag raising. All we had was a second or third generation preservation copy. And although we made the best copy of it we could in 4K HD, it still wasn't clear enough. And we felt that if we could get at the original 16-millimeter Kodachrome film, we would be able to positively identify those Marines by facial features. And we felt we were very excited when the National Archives agreed with us and decided to pull those originals. And when they went to pull them, they discovered they didn't have them. Which we were really disappointed in. And so the National Archives representative explained the process and went through all of it. It was very lengthy. It was very well done. Every copy that they had. And in the end, the best that she could determine, and she couldn't be conclusive, but her best guess was that, the original film stock had gone out to Hollywood, to Warner Brothers, to be used in the makings of newsreel films. And the original 16-millimeter stock was probably destroyed in the mere process of making print after print after print after print off of that stock, and it was probably just discarded there at the studio back in 1945. So we weren't able to identify that, and that was intriguing. It was gut-wrenching, unfortunately, but you know it was a great lesson in understanding how film was processed back in World War II, you know. So guys like Bill Janoust would carry 50 to 100-foot rolls of 60-millimeter film, which translated to between 1 and 2 minutes of footage for each of those reels. So they would send those reels back to be processed, and then when they were processed in Anacostia, Maryland, they would be put together into longer reels that could then be shipped off for reproduction. So 50 to 100-foot reels would get stuck in with other reels that they had sent back. So somewhere along the line, the flag-raising footage was eventually, the original stuff was probably sent out to Hollywood and died there.
All right, let's talk about Monday. On Monday, Matt and I have been kind of working on, he came to me with an idea, and his idea will debut on Monday. It's called Crossroads. So talk to us about the idea, Matt. Talk to us about what Crossroads, your intent with Crossroads is.
Well, you know, I feel like when it comes to sharing the combat veterans' experience, we know that combat vets don't really talk in general about the meat of their experience to the general public. But they will talk to other combat veterans. And particularly in more intimate environments, I think that combat veterans can relate on an interesting level. As you've done in some of your interviews, I mean, the opportunity to talk one-on-one in that regard provides an insight into that experience. And so what I wanted to do is I began with a series where we started sitting down with combat vets just over one microphone and chatting about their experiences. And what we're able to do is relate one experience to the other and have a conversation that I think opens them up. I began, the first one I did was with my father-in-law, who was a Marine sergeant initially with 1-9 and then 2-9. He went into Da Nang in 1965, and saw the war change dramatically, in that 13 months that he spent on the ground in North Vietnam. And you know, when we got done with the conversation, he just looked at me and said, "You know, I have never told that story from beginning to end. You know, since I left Vietnam. It's just, I will tell stories, I'll remember something, I'll tell a funny story, But he's like, I've never just sat down and shared that story. He's like, that was a pretty amazing opportunity. And so from there, I enlisted the help of some other guys, and we had the opportunity to begin. And the series will begin with after we talked to my father-in-law, Jerry Judge, about his experience in Vietnam in 65 and 66. We'll move on. I talked to had a colleague that interviewed a Marine Raider with Carlson's Raiders, who also landed on Guam and Okinawa. And then we had the opportunity to talk to a Marine who was a machine gunner who did some amazing action in the Vietnam Highlands and actually was not recognized until 2011 when he received the Navy Cross for his actions. And that is by and large one of the most compelling stories I have ever heard. It's the type of thing where you expect to come out of the basic school or out of boot camp knowing who Ned Seath is. So once they have an opportunity to hear Ned Seath's story, I think everyone's going to be pretty impressed. And so we look forward to doing this, to having an opportunity to sit down and talk to these veterans one-on-one about their experiences, not only in, you know, how they got into the Marine Corps, what their combat experiences were like, but what transition was for them afterwards, because everyone has a little bit different experience. No combat veterans' experience is a monolith.
Why the name Crossroads?
Well, it harkens back to our experience as Marines, you know, that Quantico is the crossroads of the Marine Corps. But, you know, in truth, it's about, you know, this is where you meet at the crossroad. Everybody has a different path, but there's a common experience among them all. And this is an opportunity for us to share that experience. You know, and truthfully, it's an opportunity to eavesdrop on a conversation. Because when we sit down, you know, when you sit down and have a conversation, the audience kind of drops away. And this gives the audience the crossroads the opportunity to eavesdrop on two combat veterans talking about their experience.
On Wednesday, I had the opportunity to interview Colonel Barney Barnum for almost 2 hours. He talked about the experience of he told the narrative of the action that led to him being awarded the Medal of Honor. Then he talked about having to fight with General Walt, who was the aide at Walt. Walt said, "Look, if you come and you can last a year, you can go wherever you want to." Well, he's a Medal of Honor winner, so he's in a glass case now. But he's a first lieutenant, going to be a captain. He says, "I want to go back to Vietnam," and Walt says, "What? Yeah, you can't go back to Vietnam." And he says, "I'm a captain. Like, what else am I going to do? What am I going to do? Mark time for the rest of my career?" And so Walt gets him back there, and he talks about being involved in Operation Dewey Canyon and that whole series of just, you know, body shots that were being thrown between the North Vietnamese Army, the Marine Corps, and the Army as the fight in Vietnam went on steroids. And he talks about lowering his guns and shooting flechette rounds. It's like,
yeah.
And you're listening to that going, holy shit. I mean, that's the equivalent of an infantry unit being told fix bayonets.
Right.
Yeah, that is.
Well, and here's the thing is, it's funny when you talk, you know, no veteran's experience is alike. And this is one of the things that I've fully come to appreciate over the years is that, you know, when my father-in-law lands at Da Nang as a corporal and he's told, hey, we're going to sit here and guard the airfield, this is probably going to be 3 to 4 months. You know, and the next thing he knows, he's a sergeant. His Marines are getting reorganized. He's sent to another battalion, and they're conducting night patrols. And then they're conducting ambush patrols. And then they're moving up to Fubai to establish fire bases. And, you know, the whole war changes. And he, you know, from his perspective, from the corporal and sergeant's perspective, none of it seemed to make any sense. That's going to be a completely different perspective than you would get from, like, Phil Caputo, who was an officer at the battalion headquarters in, you know, at another part of Da Nang in the same time. So.
All right. Matt, first of all, looking forward to Monday and the debut of Crossroads. And thank you for the visit today and making us a little bit smarter about relative to your experience in the entertainment business. And travel safe, and we'll talk to you sometime this weekend.
Always happy to do it. Thanks, Mac.
All right, bud. Thank you. That is Matt Morgan. Interesting guy. You know, one of the reasons why I enjoy All Marine Radio so much is just the different people that you get to cross paths with and the stories that they tell and the things that they do. So it's awesome. It's a great experience. And then also the other thing is that the healing that seems to come about because of it. So my thanks to Matt Morgan for joining us this morning. We're going to take a break. The gunner, Michael Musselman, that's right, joins us next on a Friday edition of All Marine Radio right here on the All Warrior Radio Network.
All I can say about MilitaryByOwner.com is, wow, I listed my house on your website for only 2 weeks in a tough rental market, and now my house is about to get rented. I will definitely recommend you guys to everyone in the military. Thank you.
Are you located near a military base? Advertise with Military by Owner for optimum exposure to the military community. Military by Owner has experience helping military families find, sell, or rent their home near a military base for the past 15 years. MilitaryByOwner.com, proven and dependable.